Just say congratulations to Perimeter and to Freddy on the New Horizons Prize. So I'm sure you guys are very excited. The work I'm going to talk about today was work done mainly with graduate students in Johannesburg. And let me tell you what we were trying to do. So the basic problem that we're going to address is we wanted to calculate the spectrum of anomalous dimensions to one loop in large n limit in n is equal to 4 sup Engel's theory. Now, the anomalous dimensions have received a lot of attention in n is equal to 4 sup Engel's theory recently, but most of the work that has been carried out up to now has been carried out in the planar limit. Here we're still studying large n, but in fact the limit that we are going to consider will be non-planar. And what I mean by that is the operators that we're going to consider have a free field dimension of order n. So not only are we, when we take n to infinity, not only are we considering n by n fields and letting n go to infinity, but OA itself is going to be built out of an infinite number of fields. I'm only going to consider composite operators built out of the adjoint scalars of n is equal to 4 sup Engels. We know how to include fermions and gauge fields. I'm just restricting to the adjoint scalars for simplicity. In the planar limit, when you study the dilatation operator, you find that the dilatation operator becomes the Hamiltonian of an integrable system. So it seems natural to ask here, what do we get for the dilatation operator in this sector? And what we will find is that at least at one loop, the dilatation operator reduces to a set of decoupled oscillators. So you can get a very simple description for the anomalous dimensions. And then finally, I'll think about what is the ADS-CFT dual interpretation of these results, and we'll make a link to excited giant gravitons. Now, even though I'm working to one loop in the gauge theory, you might think that I can't make a connection. The reason why we can still make a connection is because we're dealing with operators that are nearly supersymmetric. They're small deformations of supersymmetric operators. Okay, so this talk is going to be very pedestrian. All that I'm going to be doing, basically, is doing calculations at first in free field theory, where I simply sum with contractions, and then at one loop, where again, I sum with contractions. So the basic Wick contraction that I'm going to be using sits over here. So Z and Z dagger, the two-point function sets I equal to L and K equal to J. The two-point function of Z and Z dagger is non-zero. Y and Y dagger is non-zero. The other two-point functions all vanish. The operators that I'll be considering are built using N Z fields and M Y fields. And I'm going to list things that I would like you to keep track of. So I want you to keep track of the fact that N tells us how many Z fields we have, and M tells us how many Y fields we have. I will take N and M to be both order N, but I will take M to be very much less than N. And the way that I'll be using this, I will drop terms of order M over N. So both M and N are order N. But we will drop order M over N. Okay, so let's start off just setting M is equal to zero, N non-zero, which corresponds to the half BPS sector. So to give you an idea of what kind of gauge invariant operators could we build, if we want to build gauge invariant operators using a single matrix, all we can do is take the trace. If we want to use two matrices, we can take the trace of Z squared or the trace of Z times the trace of Z. And if we want to use three matrices, we can take the trace of Z cubed, the trace of Z squared times the trace of Z, or the trace of Z times the trace of Z times the trace of Z. What I want to point out here is that the number of gauge invariant operators that you can build is related to the number of partitions you can have of little n. So for example, here we can partition 3 into 3, 2 plus 1, or 1 plus 1 plus 1. I want you to remember that because later it will be important. Okay. So let's just review what happens in the planar limit. A key simplification of the planar limit is that distinct multitrace structures are orthogonal. What I mean by that is, if you calculate this two-point function over here, using that as your basic Wick contraction, you'll just get one. So I've chosen these factors, multiplying the operators so that they are normalized to one. If I then was to calculate a two-point function of a single trace operator with a double trace operator, that's the result that I find. If I hold J1, J2, and J3 fixed as I take n to infinity, the right-hand side vanishes. And this is the statement that a single trace operator will not mix with this double trace operator. Now this is a really key fact that is used in studying the planar limit, because what it means is you can restrict yourself and focus simply on single trace operators. So when I want to consider operators mixing, I only look at the single trace operators. And this is then exploited, because if you have a single trace operator, you know that the matrices sit in a certain position inside the trace, and you can make a bijection to a lattice model and have some spin system on that lattice model. So the way that we are able to map the planar limit into a lattice model relies crucially on this fact that multi-trace structures don't mix. If multi-trace structures start to mix, this picture of having a lattice model and some spin chain on the lattice model is completely out the window. You can see that if we were to let J increase, so we were to scale the number of operators, the number of matrices inside the operator with n, as soon as the scaling is something like n to the 2/3, this right-hand side is of order 1, and the mixing between single traces and double traces is completely unconstrained. In fact, this is an overestimate. This right-hand side is obtained just by summing the planar diagrams. If you sum all possible diagrams, you learn that as soon as Ji is of order root n, you start to get mixing between different trace structures. We're interested in the case where J is of order n, so the mixing between different trace structures is completely unconstrained. So the question that we want to ask is, can we find a new way of thinking about this sector of the theory that will replace the spin chain that was so successful in the planar limit? And I'm going to try to convince you that yes, we can. So we're going to need to start considering all possible multi-traces. So to do that, we want to have a nice language in terms of which we can discuss different multi-traces. So let's come back to n is equal to 2 fields. And this is the simplest case where we get 2 distinct trace structures. We can have trace Z times trace C, or the trace of Z squared. Now, if I look at these two matrices and I ask myself, these two operators, and I ask myself, what's the difference between them? Well, you can see that to get the trace of Z times the trace of Z, I need to contract I1 with I1, I2 with I2. To get the trace of Z squared, I contract I1 with I1 and I2 with I2. So the difference between these two operators is how the lower indices are permuted with respect to the upper indices. And in fact, for every such permutation, so if I write things like this, if I look at the identity permutation, I'll get the trace of Z times the trace of Z. And if I look at the permutation that swaps 1 and 2, I'll get the trace of Z squared. In this way, every permutation will correspond to a multi-trace operator, and every multi-trace operator corresponds to a permutation. So this is the language that I'm going to use. I'm going to start talking about the permutations now instead of the different multi-trace structures. You can ask yourself, does every permutation give rise to a unique multi-trace structure? And the answer is no. Any two permutations that belong to the same conjugacy class will give the same multi-trace operator. The conjugacy classes of the symmetric group can be characterized by partitions of n. So this is matching the number of gauge invariant operators that we saw before, which was just related to partitions of n. So now we've got a nice new language by which to talk about multi-trace structures. We'll refer to them through permutations. What I would like to do is introduce a slightly nicer set of operators to consider. And these are the so-called Schur polynomials. So here's the definition of a Schur polynomial. The first thing to notice is we're summing over the symmetric group. That means we're summing over every single possible multi-trace structure. So these operators have all possible multi-trace structures inside them. This coefficient with which we're summing the different multi-trace structures is a character for group element sigma in irreducible representation R. So R is a representation of Sn. It would be a Young diagram with n boxes. We know a lot about the characters of the symmetric group. So we know a lot about Schur polynomials. And many of the properties of Schur polynomials come from the properties of characters. I've written out for n is equal to 3, what do the 3 different Schur polynomials look like? And here they are. The key thing to note is we had 3 different multi-trace structures. We have 3 different Schur polynomials. And there's some linear combination of those multi-trace structures. So you can view the Schur polynomials as an alternative basis to the basis of the multi-trace structures. Why is this basis better than the multi-trace basis? Well, it's basically because of 3 facts. So the first thing is the number of Schur polynomials agrees with finite n counting. What I mean by that is, let's imagine that we set n is equal to 2. And we'll study 2x2 matrices. In this case, the trace of Z will be the sum of two eigenvalues. Let's call them lambda 1 and lambda 2. The trace of Z squared will be the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues. Now, knowing what the sum of the eigenvalues is and the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues, I could already calculate what is the sum of the cube of the eigenvalues. So in particular, if I take the trace of Z cubed, which would be lambda 1 cubed plus lambda 2 cubed, I should be able to express this in terms of things that I have. That's an easy thing to do. If we take lambda 1 plus lambda 2 times lambda 1 squared plus lambda 2 squared, you can see we get a lambda 1 cubed, we get a lambda 2 cubed, but we've also got some cross terms, lambda 1, lambda 2 squared, lambda 2, lambda 1 squared. So if we now subtract off lambda 1 plus lambda 2 cubed, this will subtract off the cross terms. We need to include a 3 here because they all come with a factor of 3. All that we're left with is 3 lambda 1 cubed minus lambda 1 cubed and 3 lambda 2 cubed minus lambda 2 cubed. So if I divide both of these by 2, I learn that the trace of Z cubed is 3 over 2 trace of Z times the trace of Z squared minus 1 half times by the trace of Z cubed. What that means is, at this level, I thought I had 3 independent multitrace structures. I don't. Only 2 of them are independent because the third one can be expressed in terms of these 2. Now, I'm taking n to infinity, so you might think I'm never going to have to worry about this. But that's a little bit too naive. Where did this problem occur? It occurred when I had 3 fields, okay, and I've got n is equal to 2. So as soon as the number of fields that I have goes bigger than n, I have to worry about these trace relations. I'm interested in the situation where the number of fields inside my operator are order n. So in particular, I may have 10 n fields. And in that situation, even though I've let n to infinity, I will be sensitive to these trace relations. The nice thing about the Schur polynomial is the Schur polynomial knows about the trace relations. And if you write down the complete set of Schur polynomials, they've already taken this into account. So they're nice from that point of view. Another thing that's nice about them is that they are orthogonal. So previously we had different multitrace structures were orthogonal. Here the Schur polynomial is orthogonal in the sense that if this young diagram is not the same as that young diagram, you just get 0. This number here for the two-point function is very easy to write down. So for example, again, if we were looking at n is equal to 3, a possible choice for this Young diagram R could be that. And what you now do is you fill in the factors of the Young diagram. And the rule for the factors, I'm just giving you some rule for some numbers. You start by putting an n there. Everywhere you come this way, you add 1. Every time you go down, you subtract 1. So I would just fill in the box adding 1 each time I move that way, subtracting 1 each time I move down. This number FR is simply a product of 1 factor for each box. So that gives you the answer for the two-point function. This is obtained not by summing just the planar graphs. You have to sum every single ribbon graph to get this result. This is just the free field theory, but you're calculating this exactly in the free field theory. And that answer holds for any number of matrices inside each of the Schur polynomials. And finally, there's a very nice formula allowing you to express operators in the trace basis in terms of a linear combination of Schur polynomials. And all that you need is the coefficient is the character of the permutation sigma that builds your multitrace operator. Okay. now, this sector of the theory is too simple for us. And the reason why it's too simple for us is we want to study anomalous dimensions. All of the operators that we write down here are half BPS. Their arbitrage is equal to the dimension. So the classical dimension, the free field dimension, is not corrected. If we want to get something non-trivial, we have to start considering operators built from more than one matrix. Now, in matrix models, you know, going from one matrix to two matrix does not mean that you've doubled the difficulty. It's much more than doubling the difficulty. So you might think, are we going to have any hope of being able to generalize this to two matrices? In fact, we will be able to generalize it, but to do that, we need to understand the Schur polynomials just a little bit better. How are the Schur polynomials working? In particular, how are these three things achieved by Schur polynomials? Here's the key idea behind Schur polynomials. So that's our free field two-point function. What I want to look at now is, let's consider a two-point function between some operator here and some operator here. What the operator looks like, I've got some coefficient A with some indices I, upper indices I, which contract with the lower indices on the Zs, and lower indices J, which contract with the upper indices on the Zs. Some examples of what I could pick for A, if I simply pick A to be a bunch of delta functions, so perhaps A contracts I1 with J1, I2 with J2, I3 with J3, then contracting A with this product of three Zs would just give me the trace of Z times the trace of Z times the trace of Z. Picking different products of delta functions would give me different multi-trace structures, but in general, I might even choose A to be a sum of that and that and that. So by picking this tensor A, I can get any particular sum of multi-trace structures that I would want to consider. Let's return now to the two-point function. I now want to calculate this in free field theory. So I pick a pair of fields, a Z and a Z dagger, and I contract the J index with the K index, the L index with the I index. When I'm contracting L and I am setting lower indices of B equal to upper indices of A. When I'm contracting J and K, I'm setting lower indices of J equal to upper indices of B. So after I've wick contracted all of the Zs and Z daggers, I'm going to be left with something like a trace of an A times a B. When I do this process of wick contracting, I have to sum over all possible ways of wick contracting Zs with Z daggers. And in fact, for each possible wick contraction, I can characterize that by permutation. So by summing over all possible wick contractions, I need to sum over all possible permutations, and I land up with this structure for this two-point function. Now, what properties would I like for A and B to make this two-point function particularly easy to calculate? If B was to commute with sigma, I could just pull B straight past that sigma. I would have sigma times sigma inverse, which would be the identity, and I would be land up with the trace of A times B. So can I find a method so that I'll construct my A's and B's so that they commute with these permutations? Well, these permutations have an action on the indices of the Z's, as we've seen. That action is reducible. So I can decompose that into irreducible components using some sort of a projection operator. These projection operators will naturally commute with permutations. And the other thing that's nice about these projection operators is that if you pick up any two projection operators and multiply them, they will give you back the projection operator if you're projecting to the same subspace. If you're not projecting to the same subspace, you'll just get zero. So in fact, the way that the Schur polynomial is able to orthogonalize the two-point function is precisely that it's a projection operator traced into this product of Z's. And when you've got that insight, it turns out that to study more than one matrix, you just construct the corresponding projection operator for that example. So let's now introduce a second matrix Y and see how much of the story generalizes. So how much of the Hopf BPS story can be generalized? So we've now got N Z's and M Y's. Once again, the most general multi-trace operator that you could think of constructing corresponds to some permutation sigma. Now that permutation is inside S N plus M. You can again ask, does every permutation give you a distinct multi-trace operator? And the answer is no. Two permutations which are related by conjugation again give you the same gauge invariant operator. But now permutation doesn't live inside the element with which I'm conjugating, does not live inside Sn plus M. It lives inside this Sn times Sm subgroup. And what this subgroup does, it swaps Z's amongst each other and it swaps Y's amongst each other. So it's actually, this is some subgroup of the full group. So we do have a nice way of talking about multi-trace operators, even in the case where we have two distinct matrices. And that leads us to the so-called Schur polynomials. So restricted Schur polynomials. So again, you've got a sum over all possible permutations. So we've got all possible multi-trace structures sitting here, and we have some coefficients sitting there which we really constructed knowing that we should have a projection operator. Let me try to explain to you what is this coefficient. So it's got a group theoretic meaning. The simplest way to understand that is to think about the group of rotations. So let's consider SO3. So we're just going to perform rotations in three-dimensional space. If I've got some point with coordinates x, y, and z, I know that rotations will mix x, y, and z. So I've got some irreducible representation here, which is three-dimensional. I could restrict myself now to rotations just around the z-axis. If I'm just looking at rotations around the z-axis, x and y will mix, and z will remain on its own. So I get a two-dimensional representation from x and y, and a one-dimensional representation from z. The matrix mixing x and y is given by this 2x2 matrix sitting at the top there, and z is just left denoted by that one sitting over there. So by looking at the subgroup, the representation that we had is no longer irreducible, and we can decompose the rows and columns of the original group element in terms of the representations of the subgroup. We then define what's called the restricted trace. So tracing over the two, if you remember this corresponded to x and y, which was that block over there, you don't take the trace over the full matrix, you take the trace only over the block sitting at the top there. The trace over the one, that would correspond to the element that was the z, that just gives you that number over there. So this is the so-called restricted trace. What we've done is we've looked at a subgroup, looked at the irreducible representations of the subgroup, and that's told us how to trace. Now, for the Schur polynomial, what we do is we look at some subgroup of Sn plus m. So we've got chi r. This is a Young diagram with n plus m boxes. This is a representation of Sn plus m. I'll now look at the Sn times Sm subgroup. That subgroup's representations are labeled by two Young diagrams, one which specifies a representation of Sn, so it has n boxes, and one which specifies a representation of Sm, so it has m boxes. Now, in general, when I look at this irreducible representation, it can appear more than once. So I need a multiplicity label which will keep track of these different representations. And when I calculate the trace, one of the things that it's mathematically consistent to do is when I sum over the row indices and the column indices, I can actually use different copies of this representation for the row and the column. If I do use different copies, it turns out that I'm not even summing elements on the diagonal. They're displaced from the diagonal. But it's something that makes perfect mathematical sense, and we'll see we need that to get a full set of operators. So there's some multiplicity indices, one telling me what the row index of the restricted trace is, one telling me what the column index of the restricted trace is. Now we had nz fields, so this representation r is naturally associated with the z fields, and this representation s is naturally associated with the y fields. Again, I wrote down some examples of restricted Schur's here when n is equal to m is equal to 1. And all that we're doing is we've changed from the trace basis to the restricted Schur basis. What is nice about the restricted Schur basis is that, first of all, it again takes into account trace relations. So it's again consistent with finite n counting. Secondly, they again diagonalize the free field two-point function. And you'll notice it's diagonal on all labels. So R has to match with S, little r with little t, little s with little u, and the multiplicity indices have to match. So the first multiplicity index and the second multiplicity index also has to match to get a non-zero answer. This number that sits here is again a very well-defined number. It's that fr together with some dressing, which can again be read off the Young diagram. So we know that number completely explicitly, not too important exactly what it is, but it's known. And finally, there's again a very simple way to write general multitrace operators as a linear combination of restricted Schur polynomials. Now, I should mention that in the case of one matrix, it was unique how you build this new basis. In the case of multi-matrices, there are other ways of organizing the local operators. One way of organizing them is to use the Brouwer algebra. So that was put forward by Ramgoolam and Kimura. And there's another basis that you can use, which makes the global quantum numbers of the space-time manifest. And that was put forward by Brown, Heslop, and Ramgoolam. I think these bases are also very interesting to study. Today we're going to focus on the restricted truths. Okay. So now we've got the basis that we want to study. Our task now is to evaluate the dilatation operator acting on this basis. So the dilatation operator at one loop takes that form. If we allow the one loop dilatation operator to act on the restricted truth, we know that the result will be some linear combination of restricted truths, just because the restricted truths are complete. And the specific linear combination that we get is coded into this matrix M. At this point, this result is exact. We haven't made any approximations, but we will soon start to approximate it. So let's just unpack this a little bit, what's appearing. So this gamma R is the matrix representing the permutation which swaps 1 and M plus 1. Now, these different indices were associated to different fields. This particular permutation is swapping an index associated with a Y field with an index associated with a Z field. So this swaps a Z and a Y. This IR prime T prime is defined as follows. So you'll notice that I'm performing the trace over a direct sum of two representations. So I might, for example, be performing a direct sum over here. I have R, which for this illustration I'll pick to be that representation. Over here I have T, which I will pick to be that representation. So these are both representations of S4. I can look at an S3 subgroup, and I know that this will decompose into that representation and that representation. So I'll get all possible representations obtained by dropping one box. And this will decompose into that representation and that representation. And now you see this representation here is equivalent to that representation there. So I can define a map which will map me from here to there. And if you want to think about this concretely as a matrix, it would be a matrix with zeros everywhere, except off the diagonal, somewhere there would be some ones, which would take me from this subspace into that subspace. This is known as an intertwiner. It's a map from representation T prime, something obtained by dropping one box from Young diagram T, to R prime, something obtained by dropping one box from Young diagram R. So that's the meaning of those two maps sitting over there. And finally, this operator P over here, this implements the restricted trace. So if you're calculating the restricted trace, the one way to do it is you just take trace of P times by whatever you want to take the restricted trace of. I think this result is quite intuitive because there you'll see we had a product of two commutators, and here we've again got a product of two commutators. This one is living inside the carrier space of R. This one is living inside the carrier space of T. This is mapping us between the two. And these permutations are swapping Z and Y indices. Okay. Now, when you start to study this dilatation operator, you want to find some limit in which you can somehow simplify the calculation. And one limit that the calculation simplifies is if you start to take some long columns or some long rows in your Young diagram. The reason why that simplifies is if you have a Young diagram with, say, four long rows, it doesn't mix with Young diagrams that would have five long rows or three long rows. So you start to find that the operators that mix at large N all have the same number of rows or columns. I want to show you a specific case where we evaluated this dilatation operator. So I'm going to consider two columns here. The reason why two columns are simpler is that the multiplicity labels that appear in the Schur polynomial don't appear for two columns or two rows. There's a total of six possible operators that could mix. B0 and B1 are labeling how many boxes you have in the second Young diagram, in the second column and the first column. Now, when you calculate what does the dilatation operator look like acting on these operators, so there's six possible operators, and how do they mix? Well, I'm going to show you one term out of it, and I'm warning you, it does look messy. So that's what it looks like. So the dilatation operator acting on OB can produce things that look like OB, OC, OD, OE, OF, even an OA. So there's OA. So these six different patterns mix. The other thing that happens is here we had B0 and B1. we start to mix with B0 minus 1 and B0 plus 1 as well. So you get all kinds of mixing. In fact, if you look at the pictures of the Young diagrams, the operators that are allowed to mix differ in the placement of a single box. What is the use of a result like this? Well, we can put this onto a computer and ask ourselves, what does the spectrum look like? If you put this onto a computer and diagonalize it, you find something quite remarkable. So for example, for the case of m is equal to 3, which is what we were looking at, you have 6 operators. You find that, in fact, you get a set of 6 harmonic oscillators. 4 of the harmonic oscillators have a frequency of 0. 1 of the harmonic oscillators has a frequency of 8 gengmel squared. And when you diagonalize that dilatation operator, so we'll be using MATLAB, it has an accuracy of 16 decimal places, you really see an 8, 16 zeros. 16, 24, 32, perfect integers for the eigenvalues. So this is a very nice result. It suggests that there should be a simple way to get hold of the spectrum of the dilatation operator. And it suggests that we need to make some sort of an approximation. So we are going to start making some approximations now. What we're going to assume is something that we call that the displaced corners approximation. So here I've got a Young diagram with 3 rows. And what I assume is the difference in the length of any 2 rows and the shortest row are all of order n. And this will be true for the generic operator that you can think of. When you make this approximation that these different row lengths are of order n, it simplifies the action of the symmetric group. And what we use it for specifically is for the calculation of these operators that implement the restricted trace. They get a particularly simple description. And the reason why they get a simple description is that there's an extra unitary group symmetry. If you have p rows, you get an extra up symmetry, and you can use this symmetry to construct those projection operators. In this displaced corners approximation, because of this new symmetry, there's a new conservation law. So what is the new conservation law that appears? It's the following. If I think about these labels, so there is R, so let's imagine that I have some Young diagram R, and I have Young diagram little r. In little r, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 boxes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So I drop those 2 boxes from big R to get little r. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I drop that box, and I drop that box. The new conservation law is that when the operators start to mix, the only operators that are allowed to mix are operators where I drop 2 boxes from the first row, 1 box from the second row, 1 box from the third row. So I'm going to start collecting the number of boxes I need to drop from each row of big R to produce little r into a vector. And the only operators that mix have that same relation, the box that I drop from big R to get little r. If I now calculate what does this operator look like, the dilatation operator in this displaced corners approximation, it's a product of 2 terms. The one is a delta, the one is m. Delta acts only on the Young diagram R, which is on the Zs. M acts only on the Young diagram U and the multiplicity labels, which is associated with the Ys. I must be summed less than J, and it runs over the rows of the Young diagram. So if we have 6 rows, there would be a total of 15 different values for IJ. So we would have a total of 15 different operators delta, 15 different operators M. They would all simultaneously commute. They can be diagonalized simultaneously. So let me tell you what this delta IJ looks like. Here is an example of delta 1,3. Delta 1,3 has an action on the Young diagram little r. What it does is the following. It produces 1 term that looks just like the original Young diagram. No change, it's just scaled by some coefficient. It produces another term where we've taken a box from the first row and we move it to the third row. And it produces another term where we take a box from the third row and move it to the first row. So that's delta 1, 3. Delta 5, 6 would do the same things with rows 5 and 6. Now we can look at the coefficients of these different terms. Those three coefficients are specified in terms of two numbers. The first term is positive, it's the sum of the two numbers. The next two terms are negative, and it's the square root of the product of the two numbers. What are these numbers? Well, here's an example of delta 1, 2. There's the two numbers sitting there explicitly. B0 plus B2 is the length of that row. B0 plus B1 plus B2 is the length of the first row. So in fact, the numbers that appear inside this operator are just related to the row lengths of the Young diagram. The trick to diagonalizing the delta ij's goes as follows. We can realize delta ij as an element of this UP Lie algebra that we have acting. So I've just picked a basis, a usual basis for UP. These e's, they're zero everywhere, except in row k and column l, where there's a 1. And I can extract from here an SU2 Lie algebra. So this would be a usual raising operator. That would be the usual lowering operator. And this would play the role of J3. It closes the usual algebra. To see the relevance of this, well, let me remind you of the usual raising operator acts in that way. So lambda gets raised to lambda plus 1. The lowering operator drops lambda to lambda minus 1. And that's what the coefficients look like, a square root of a product of two numbers. This is very similar to the action of our delta 1, 2, these last two terms. You can see that B1 has been lowered by 1 or raised by 1. And the square root is again a product of two numbers. So at large n, I can simply, so these two factors are not exactly the same, but at large n, for the term that lowers B, I can simply add a 1 to that second factor, and at leading order in n, that doesn't change anything. And for the term that raises B, I can add a 1 to the first factor in that square root, which doesn't change anything. At this point, these operators delta ij are given by a term that looks like the identity in this representation, a lowering operator plus a raising operator. So diagonalizing delta ij is just like the problem of diagonalizing, say, jx in the good J3 quantum number basis in quantum mechanics. So we know how to do that. One of the things that you can do is this Young diagram R, these row lengths are all of order n, and they differ by either adding a box or removing a box. So we can trade these row lengths for continuous variables. And if you do that, the continuous variable that you can trade is this one, xi. So for example here, the length of the first row, so let me call x1 would be equal to the length of the first row minus the length of the third row divided by n plus the length of the third row. And for this problem, we'd also have an x2 variable for this row. So we'd be trading the Young diagram for an x1 and an x2. In terms of that x1 and x2, this delta ij becomes that differential operator sitting there, which is very nice. If you solve the eigenvalue problem of delta ij numerically, and you compare it to the answer that you get from solving this continuum problem, the spectrum that you get is exactly the same. And eyeballing the eigenfunctions, you really are just reconstructing Gaussians times some Hermite polynomial. So this continuum limit gives you a very accurate description of the problem. So that's how we solve this delta ij eigen problem. We still have to solve the eigen problem associated with these matrices M. Now, the way that we solve that eigen problem associated with the matrices M is, first of all, if you just construct these matrices numerically and you see what does the answer look like, there's a very nice way of labeling these different eigenfunctions. And we label the eigenfunctions by directed graph. So for every directed graph of this type that you can draw, there is an eigenfunction. And more than that, the directed graph gives you a summary of the different eigenvalues that can appear. You'll see that here there was a sum over I and j. So what we would expect to get you in particular would be delta 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, 2, 3, 2, 4, and 3, 4. So we get a total of 6 terms. For this particular graph shown here, only 2 of those terms appear. So pick a restricted Schur polynomial, and let me tell you where this one comes from. So that one corresponds to having four rows. So we've got a total of four rows for the restricted Schur. If you take a look at dot number one, so dot number one is associated to row one of the Young diagram. There are a total of one, two, three arrows leaving dot one. This would be an eigenfunction where we drop three boxes from the first row of one, of big R to get little r. If you look at box two, there are two arrows leaving the second row. So you would drop two boxes from row three, again, there are two directed lines leaving it. And for row four, one directed line leaving it. So if you were looking at a restricted Schur polynomial, where this would have been r, the whole thing, and after you drop those boxes, you get little r, the eigenproblem that you would get for those matrices M, that would be one of the eigenvectors. And if you want to know what are the different eigenvalues, the matrix M12 would have had an eigenvalue 4. And you get that just by counting those four lines. The matrix M13 would have had an eigenvalue 2, which you get by counting those two lines. The matrix M14 would have had an eigenvalue 0 because there's no line stretching between 1 and 4. So this was just observed numerically, just a way of labeling the eigenfunctions, the simultaneous eigenvectors of these different matrices Mij. The question is now, can you prove that this happens analytically? So to do that, the first thing that you realize is if you want to count these directed graphs, is there a nicer language to talk about these directed graphs? And yes, there is. You can view them as permutations. So I've taken this directed graph and I've just redrawn it over here. You should identify the thick black line at the bottom with the thick black line at the top. This point over there corresponds to that point there. Now you can see there's one directed line which goes back to that node. That's this line coming here and coming back there. Then there are two lines that go to that second node. There are these two lines labeled 2 and 3 which leave this node coming to that node. There's one going from this node back to that node. That's this line labeled 4. So these two pictures are just different ways of drawing exactly the same configuration. But now from this picture, you can read off a permutation. Because 1 goes to 1, 4 goes to 2, 6 goes to 3, 2 to 4, 3 to 5, 5 to 6, and 7 to 7. Now, not all permutations will give you different directed graphs, because if I was to swap those three labels over there, or those two labels, or those two, I get the same graph. And equivalently, if I swap the label sitting at the bottom here, I get the same graph. So not all permutations are equivalent to distinct directed graphs. I, in fact, have to pick up permutations that live inside this double coset. So I'm dividing by H, where H is the subgroup that swaps those numbers there. From this Young diagram over here, you read off that H. So H would be S3. I dropped three boxes from the first line, times S2, times S2, times S1. So H I can read directly again off the set of Young diagram labels for the restricted Schur. So if you count this, if you count the number of graphs in this way, you can prove it's equal to the number of restricted Schur polynomials. So at least you know the number of labels will always be equal to the number of eigenvectors that you want to label. Now, when you've learned to count something, you've usually learned something about their structure. We've now learned that these are elements of a double coset. So you can ask yourself, well, how do you use that structure? For any finite group, you have a notion of a Fourier transform. So if you've got a function on the group, you can use a different basis, which is given by the matrix elements of the irreducible representations. And that's just the normal notion of a Fourier transform on a finite group. For the double coset, you've also got a notion of a Fourier transform. And while we constructed, what is this Fourier transform? So it's given in terms of this object over here. If you think about the usual e to the ikx that you integrate, k labels momentum eigenstates, x labels position eigenstates. So these are the two labels of the two different bases. Here, sigma labels the directed graph, and s, mu, and nu labels the original labels that the Y matrix had. To construct the Fourier transform, you take this thing, you multiply it in the restricted Schur, and you sum over representation S, and the multiplicity labels mu and nu. And then what we did was we just took this operator, plugged it into the dilatation operator, and asked, what do you get? And in fact, it turns out that this is indeed the exact eigenfunction. And you can again check numerically, are these the eigenvectors of those matrices? And the answer is yes. So these operators now are the ones that diagonalize the M's. So if you want to work out the spectrum of anomalous dimensions at large n of these operators, it amounts to the following problem. So you draw some permutation sigma, which corresponds to some directed graph. You then think about each of these lines in the directed graph being a spring with a hook constant 1. For these three springs over here, you add them to get something with a hook constant 3. That's how hook constants add for springs in parallel. This would have a hook constant 1. That would have a hook constant 1. You then solve for the natural frequencies of that system. The natural frequencies here are indicated as omega I. The anomalous dimension is then, so there's the free field dimension. The anomalous dimension is G angle squared times by a sum over the natural frequencies of that system, where you can excite each of those natural frequencies to any level ni. If we express this in terms of the Toft coupling, that looks like the Toft coupling times ni over lambda. So at least at one loop, it looks like you've got a continuous spectrum that switches on smoothly when lambda is equal to naught. If this behavior holds to higher loops, I think that that would be quite significant, because it means that when you are counting low energy states of a black hole or something like that, it's not good enough to count just the BPS states. Because there's many states here, the ones for ni of order n, that have a non-zero anomalous dimension. They are not BPS. But when you take n to infinity, the anomalous dimension goes to 0. So if you're just counting the BPS states, you wouldn't count those. Okay, in this computation, lambda must be fixed. You cannot see it from this one loop computation. If you go to two loops, you can ask yourself now how should I scale things so that the two loop is naturally a small correction compared to the first loop? And then you learn that, in fact, you should be scaling things as you normally do in the Toft limit. Okay, so I just wanted to tell you now, what is the ADS-TFT dual interpretation of these results? So, what we're considering here is a system of giant gravitons. Each row in our big Young diagram R corresponds to a specific giant graviton. So how do we excite these giant gravitons? It's by attaching open strings to them. We know the world volume theory of a giant graviton would be a U1 gauge theory. And if you have just a single giant, if you have P giants, there would be a UP gauge theory. And in particular, because it's a gauge theory, we know that we have the Gauss law, so the divergence of E would be equal to the charge density. If I integrate the charge density over the world volume of the giant to get the total charge Q, I can use the divergence theorem to write this as an integral of E dot dA over the boundary of the giant, but the giant's world volume is compact, so this naturally vanishes. So what it means is the only open string configurations I can have of the system are ones that would respect having a total charge of 0. And if I think about what those look like, I could never have a configuration like this because there's only a single string ending on those. So I'm representing the black dots here by giant gravitons. And these red lines are the open strings. This would never be an allowed giant graviton configuration because those two giants over there could never have 0 charge sitting on their wall volumes. Whereas for these three configurations sitting over here, you really could arrange to have 0 charge sitting on the giant graviton's world volume. So if you were to just draw some pictures of what would be the allowed state space for these open string stretches between giants, you would naturally draw the directed graphs that we derived from solving the dilatation operator problem spectrum. I think let me move to some conclusions. So first of all, one conclusion is we have families of operators with a definite scaling dimension. They are labeled by permutation, and this permutation gives you a visible connection to a dual string theory picture where you have giant gravitons with open strings attached. To tell you exactly what does this operator look like with the good scaling dimension, I've written an example of it sitting over here. So here we have our restricted Schur polynomial, which sits there. you have here a harmonic oscillator wave function. That harmonic oscillator wave function is a function of some coordinates. What are those coordinates? They're given by the row lengths of Young diagram R. We also have some permutation sigma here, and that permutation sigma is related to the directed graphs that we draw, which labels the eigenfunctions really associated with the Y problem. So we're learning here that the Zs are associated with a giant graviton, and the Ys are playing the role of some open strings that are attached to the operator. And that's a very explicit formula for what the operator of good scaling dimension looks like, and we can write down exactly what the anomalous dimensions are. So I think I'll stop there.
Does something special happen if you're in a representation where several rows have the same length?
Yes. So if you're in a situation where several rows have the same length, the approximations that we've used up to now break down. And what happens is you can start having transitions between these graphs that we drew with those directed lines. So that's something that we're studying at the moment, but it's beyond what we can sort of do reliably.
Can you understand that as, well, my guess was it had something to do with the emergence of an non-abelian symmetry group?
Yeah. So that's exactly what we are trying to argue for. And I would say that we've got some indications that that's what's happening, but we're not confident enough yet to talk about it. Yeah.
Otherwise, those Bs were of order n.
Those Bs were of order n, that's right. So what that means is, if you check in the space-time, you're considering giant gravitons that are well separated. As soon as two rows become of the same length, these giants are really becoming coincident. Yeah.